Welcome.
thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome. Mm-hmm. And Chris, on the way over here, I had asked Chris to write a biography, and I was just wondering, Chris, if you could share that with us.
Just wanted to put a short clip together. My story is connected to an ongoing spiritual evolution, which gives me a place to begin to articulate my inner vision and meaning and direction and work. My primary transformative experience came out of an extended vision quest which took me across America, listening to the stories of the people and the land, including the reservations, and which culminated in a ghetto in California. When I experienced the sacrificial love and humility of poor and oppressed people, I awakened to a higher reality and became more sensitized to the inhumanity of systems of power and wealth, the ways of the world. Since then, I have worked within the creative spirit of nonviolence, which is a breath of freedom.
I mean, the writing, it speaks for itself, but it draws us to the topic at hand, which, well, there are many things in the prose piece you have there, but the first thing that comes to my mind is work. What is work to you? What does work mean to you?
Well, karma yoga is service to humanity. Out of love and service to humanity, and especially those who have been beaten down, those who are poor and dispossessed, and to attempt to be a voice and to give people access, and just to humanize, get back to the humility of creation and the search for knowledge and the service and love to our brothers and sisters, and to, you know, try to do away with things which are a hindrance to that, you know, systems. Right now I find myself doing a lot of work with people in prison, and the prisons themselves are really horrible places, systems of great violence and oppression. By being, you know, going there. So, I mean, that's one, you know, one way we can explore. And I've tried to do some work with the peace movement and try to end the war, you know, the present war in Afghanistan and Iraq. And
but I felt like you wanted to say a little bit more about some of the work that you were doing with individuals who are in prison.
Well, before you had asked about forgiveness, you know, we approach without judgment. You know, if a person does something like murder another human being, to approach that person with love rather than judgment, you know, and that offers a space for forgiveness. And I believe it's more of a discipline to when somebody is on that level, you know, of cruelty to say something like that, or if somebody does something to you, to not have a knee-jerk reaction and do to them. So it's a discipline, and I we feel that that's the foundation, that mercy is the first connection, compassionate understanding of another human being, regardless of what they did, the circumstance that they're in presently. Sure. At the moment. Being responsible for your actions, I feel that in order to be responsible, to allow somebody to take responsibility for their action,
right.
I think punishment doesn't allow a person to be responsible. It just, when you slap a child, or when you treat another human being with punishment, I don't believe that you're giving them the opportunity to be accountable for the things they've done in the past.
I was wondering, Chris, if we could talk a little bit about the methods of the methods that you use to achieve the work that you do.
I believe in nonviolence. I don't believe in violent solutions. So I think that's one of the foundations. And in order to get there, there's certain, you know, it's a skill that needs to be learned, like any other skill. And a discipline, like any other discipline.
How did you come to this place of utilizing nonviolence as an effective means of communication and expression?
Through experience. Seeing violence itself, any kind of violence or systematic poverty or warfare or prisons and consumerism and depleting the earth of its resources, those are all forms of violence, and I don't see how our present path is gonna, it seems that we're on a path of destruction. And from my perspective, in order to get off that path of destruction, it's like getting off the wheel. You know, the wheel's going and you step off the wheel.
Right.
So there's a certain amount of emancipation, or what you would say, detachment. Emancipate yourself from that which would destroy you, or emancipate yourself from that which would do you harm.
Right.
So I think that there's a certain emancipation that needs to, a certain detachment that has to, detaching from violence.
It really begins with our own observation of our own dark nature, our own, the hatred that resides within each human being must be recognized and addressed in order to let it go and free it. Let it go someplace where it doesn't do any harm.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, with the, for instance, with blaming terrorism, like pointing the finger, the terrorist, the criminal. You know, I think there's a, you're absolving yourself. I mean, it's, we there are tendencies within humanity, within ourselves, which lead to violence or destruction or greed or selfishness or all these other things, ignorance, these forms of ignorance.
Right.
Those things are within us, and to pretend that we are pure of those things, I think, is a great damage. I do agree that we do have to be aware of, like, that aspect of our nature. Right. But I also believe that there is another side of our nature, which is more compassionate and loving and searching for truth, or more free, to be free human beings. I think that's also part of our nature. To not give your energy to the one, and to give your energy to the more positive one. That's what I try to practice. And then when I see it in myself, I try to work in it in myself. And then when I see it manifested in other forms, I try to encourage positive movements within other people or organizations, and try to disconnect from those negative aspects. You had spoken about this show is about religion, and that's one of the themes of from different scriptures of liberation. You know, liberating ourselves from different bondages of those forms of ignorance and darkness and greed and selfishness and vanity and violence and hatred, and all those things are forms of bondage.
Yes.
And so the liberation is to to see it and then to not participate in it and to evolve beyond it.
Yeah.
So I think that, but the work then, from your original question about work, the work then is to, like, try to create positive forms. To see those negative forms, and then to create positive forms. And one of the things I'm working on is with this organization called Jesus the Liberator Seminary, in which we offer theology courses for people in prison. And so it's a positive education. It's not indoctrination into a particular denomination or way of thinking. It's just a platform we use, and it tries to tap into to see another human being, to reach to another human being, to listen to them, to validate their experience, you know, their feelings, whatever they may be feeling, to say that God is within you, or however you define that word God, that love, that life force, is within you, and we're just here to try to help you to bring it out. Process of bringing out that life force, that creative life force, is a way of healing, and so it is a rehabilitation. The problem with the prisons is there's no rehabilitation. It's basically a dungeon People are thrown there, they're discarded. And there's also a lot of policy things that could be done as far as decriminalizing drugs, for instance, making drug addiction a health issue rather than a crime issue. Or the same with mental health. A lot of people in prison are either mentally ill or drug addicts, and that treating people like that as a criminal rather than trying to help them as address it as a root concern of health, right, and public safety and health, I think would empty half the prisons, and that would then reduce the tax burden upon, you know. But the prisons themselves, like the military in this country, are two big industries. And, yeah, and when a culture and a nation has two of their biggest industries on war and prisons, then that really speaks to the priorities of where this culture is going. Again, there's more positive aspects of, there's a lot of beautiful people in this country, and the rehabilitation, that process of rehabilitation and healing within the prison system is one form of work, a service to others. You know, we offer free education, and it tends to be more. And again, back to religion, it's a karma yoga.
Yes.
A practice of service, but it's also a jina yoga, which is the path of knowledge. So we are using knowledge in the service of poorer people.
Right.
And it can also be a rajas, contemplative knowledge. So there are forms of the forms of meditation that when we clarify the mind, or what's called mental afflictions, you know, when people become aware of what theologically is called a sin or sociologically is called a crime, you know, whether a sin or a crime, when we become aware of, like, I think the Greeks called it a mistake, or other people have called it disharmony.
Yes.
So, I mean, whatever word you choose to use, semantics, when something is out of balance, and the process of putting things back into balance, so we have a conscious decision to go to do this or to do that. It may in time right itself, but I do believe that we human beings have a conscious choice to do this or to do that. So
that's also true.
It is what we do with our time and energy that matters.
I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about your own, how your prose piece here and your vision quest and awakening tie into your religious practices.
Okay. Well, I grew up in Buffalo, you know, working class Catholic. So I grew up within the Christian and specifically Catholic way of understanding religion. And I would go to church, you know, my mother, she took us to church on a devotional, you know, regular schedule. And I put myself into it, you know, and yeah. I believe that this was the path, you know, that this thing of whatever God, you know, whatever ultimate meaning and this higher truth, you know, I thought, well, this is the pathway to get there. And then as I grew older, you know, from a childhood to, you know, teenager, I start to, you know, look at it a little deeper, you know, and say, you know, where's the love? You know, what I want to feel it. I want to really experience. They are intellectually discussing something, but there was a disconnect between the intellectual articulation of it and the feeling, the feeling of being connected. And then also this thing of like having just one path. Like, for instance, I read in the New Testament that Jesus said, "In my Father's house there are many mansions." So I understood that as like there are many pathways in order to understand. So I began to explore, you know, different sensibilities and even the articulation of God as a father or God as a mother, you know, or to personalize it. And then looking at God as an impersonal sense or a force. But the way different religions, denominations, or pathways experienced it. But then I wanted to, but that was under the roof of my mother, you know, mm-hmm. and in a larger way, under the roof of the mother church.
Yeah.
So in order for me to be independent, to be a free spirit, to think for myself and to have my own conscience, I had to break away from the tradition that I grew up in. And so I went out into the world, you know, 18 and that, and went and sought after experience, mm-hmm. and to understand, really these basic questions of who am I, and what is my purpose kind of thing, and to really explore these on a deeper level, and to really get to the crux of the matter, and to push the issue until I got some answer.
Right.
And I always had this, I grew up under the house of America too. Mm-hmm. I grew up under the house of my family, under the house of my church, and I also grew under the house of my nation.
Right.
And so I had to come to terms with all those different houses that I was born into.
Right.
And to understand them for what they are. So I felt the need to explore, just like I explored what is this thing of God, I had to explore what is this thing of America.
Right.
And what is this thing of me? So I had to ask all these other questions of like, and to really search them and to put some effort, because I think it's a lot about intention, what is the intention of the heart? But to go back to the question then, I saw, for instance, different forms of Catholicism in New Orleans, where the you had African sensibilities and Caribbean sensibilities and forms of belief systems and really culture and the way people relate to one another. And also in the desert in New Mexico and Arizona, there was Catholicism in the indigenous forms, of the Native American people who synthesized. So I saw Catholicism synthesized with African and Indian culture and society within the house of the Catholic Church, and that expanded my sense of it was beyond the European, and then it gets into the history of colonialism, and what brought religion here, but I mean, my feeling is just that we're all people,
right?
And that religion, it could be the opiate of the masses, and it could be a crutch, and many people use it for that way, but the positive aspect of religion is that it's a form of knowledge. It's a way of articulating and understanding the world around us, which has been time tested.
Yes.
And has undergone reformations, and within every religion has gone through different periods of like cleansing and rearticulation. And Dr. Martin Luther King, for instance, would articulate in that tradition of Cesar Chavez and Dorothy Day, of connecting religion with justice, and justice with the social order.
Right.
That the moral law has to square with the laws of society, and so this moving towards justice and couching it in a theological language, that's expanding it. And Gandhi would do the same thing with the caste system in India, and bringing the what he called the Harijans, the children of Hari. Hare Krishna and, yeah. and the Hari, but he connected the Hari, the Harijans, with the poor and the oppressed, the lowest caste order. And so he allowed the entrance of the temple, and Bhave, Vinobe Bhave and others, but that was and I contemplate that too, of that of a rural society. And then there's things here in the United States about I've connected with some of the migrant farm workers, and there's been pilgrimages across New York State, And I believe that the migrant farm workers, primarily from Mexico and Guatemala, are closer to the earth. They are people of the earth, you know. And the one thing you taught me about Adam and Adama,
oh, yeah,
you know, that man, that humanity and the earth are the same root.
Man and clay are very much intertwined, as that's what we are in a sense.
Right, right. And the a lot of this debate over immigrants, you know, a lot of the migrant workers, the farm workers, are people of the collective conscience of the clay. They are the ones who are providing our food for us. And yet there is an aspect of this culture that wants to punish. And I still think we have to do some work on racism. You know, there are still some people within this culture that are tied into racial consciousness,
right,
and are still in bondage to racism. And I think that plays into the immigrant and also to the, you know, this war on terrorism or whatever it's called, you know, this endless war and this attack upon immigrants, and most of the prisons are people of color. So I think racism is a big bondage that we need to be liberated from.
I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about how the whole notion of understanding love and forgiveness, as they interweave, how they play into what we're talking about here.
Well, to see another person as a human being, to understand another human being, and to love them without judgment. Yeah, I think our love is increased when we begin to understand another person.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we can love somebody, but we can love them deeper and deeper the more we understand them.
The contextual framework from which different people operate, meaning different cultures have different ways, values.
Right, which should be a strength. Different traditions, different cultures, different religions, different ways of being should be an interwoven strength.
You've done many different types of work, and in getting back to the prose piece, I just wanted to ask you, when you set off, what were you looking for?
Well, and I don't even know if I was thinking in those terms, in a sense of like an objective, you know, an objective to be obtained. To seek after something that you treasure. There's some sense of, I'm born into this world, right? You know, and what's going on here? And I want to know, I want to feel like alive. I want to know I'm alive,
right?
You know, and so that was the impetus. That was the intention to feel alive and to know, to have a knowledge of my life. And I think that process of like self-discovery should be done when you're younger. We should give opportunities for people to explore things like that when they're younger. And then when you reach a certain age, you see that you go and find a gift, and then you bring that gift back for others to share. So it may seem like this time of self exploratory is like a selfish endeavor, and on one level it is, but once you have experienced that process,
yes,
then you begin to share what you have discovered and with others. We all have to go to school, right? I mean, we don't even have a choice with that. I think this more self-discovery is a different kind of schooling. It's a different experience that you go out into the world, and you're kind of education or awareness of the world. But then the way that I've discovered that was through service to others. And that's where when I served others, I felt compassion. I felt a deeper sense of being alive.
Fulfillment. Yeah.
To seek after knowledge just for its own sake, or art for art's sake, or knowledge for knowledge's sake, or whatever it may be. Just endless speculations upon the mysteries of creation.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, that knowledge is only made real when it's shared with other people, or when you help another person, or you experience suffering. When you feel suffering and you transform suffering into joy.
Right.
It's you don't get paid money for that, but it feels like life. But we also, I feel that this sense of community is we need to. It's hard because the United States is any nation really is a collection of communities. But it's unique in this. I don't know if we have a national, like in times past, there has been a local deity, or like a national god, so to say. Or there has been like a custom or a tradition which was shared by all the people in the community. Unfortunately, that the thing that binds us together is consumption.
Yeah.
And that in itself doesn't seem to be, well, it's destructive. It's destroying, causing the greenhouse, So one of the other methods is fasting. And that fasting is not just with abstaining from food, it's also abstaining from these other negative afflictions that we have, such as consumption and greed, or this belief in self. What we're talking about of knowledge of self is different than being selfish. To just pursue your own, to lust after your own rewards, regardless of anything around you, is encouraged and is a form of selfishness.
And runs contrary to the teaching from the Bhagavad Gita, even, that says to relinquish the fruits of action, to relinquish the fruits of our work, right? To do things of themselves for themselves.
Right, because when you take the fruits of your action, it's in a sense you're idolizing. You're freezing it in time, and you're not allowing the spirit to flow freely through.
Right.
And you may not see the seeds you planted. It's a natural law that the person who plants the seed takes time to germinate.
Right.
And to seek its roots in the dark soil, and then in time it will break the surface of the ground, and then grow towards the sunlight. That whole process is not just born in an instant, but it takes a continuum. And so the person who may have planted that seed in the ground may not be around in the time of the harvest, when the fruits of it. So
right.
Joel may plant a seed with a radio show, and that seed may be taken up by a listener who will then take it and build upon it. And it's just like even in economics, where you have when you build a house, the person who, the mason who lays the cornerstone for the house, has a different kind of skill than the carpenter, mm-hmm. who puts the boarding up and that. So every person has so to see it just in individualistic terms seems to me contrary to the laws of nature. Just like even in the basics of life, a man and a woman come together and create a child.
Right.
So from the very foundations of life, there are two individuals who create one. And so this communal, this thing of selfishness is contrary to the laws of nature and to the laws and religion, to your question. When religion is within nature like that, the spirit of life, to be active with our sense of justice, if we see suffering, to try to address it.
Right.
You know, and to.
What are some practical ways that we can alleviate suffering?
Well, become aware of who you are. I mean, the
seems the first step, right?
Well, I don't know if it's the first step, but I'm just saying that to say, like, what is your gift? You know, if there are people who are devotional, like to feed somebody who is hungry. If somebody's hungry, you give them a piece of food, and that's a form of alleviating suffering.
Right.
And then there's also, in that process of giving the food, there's you are connecting emotionally with another human being, because this sense of isolation or loneliness is a form of violence. And when we feel disconnected or isolated or repressed or oppressed, we want to lash out. And generally speaking, so I think being compassionate and not seeing it as an act of charity. You know, it's not that you're bestowing some great gift upon another human being. You're simply being human, you know.
Right.
It is very human to extend your love and compassion to another human being. And you can't put it's not about rewards, and it's not about accolades. It's simply the very human thing to do. I think we've lost this sense of humanity, that even like this, to be charitable, you know, is somehow, you know, people are put on a pedestal because they're charitable. Well, it shouldn't be that way. It's very natural.
It should be. Yeah, it reminds me of there's actually the word tzedakah, which is Hebrew for charity. Actually is derived from the root for righteousness.
Mm-hmm.
So that there's charity has this bestower and bestowed, whereas if the act that is given is out of righteousness, then there's something that's more direct and more obligatory, that it's an obligation. It's an obligation to give.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see what I'm saying?
I think so. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel that we have to go to the places that are where people are suffering, and to really be a voice. That's one method, and then to directly connect, to provide basic needs for another human being. The people are well fed and with nutritious food.
Just fundamental human
people
rights.
People are, yeah, fundamental human rights of shelter and
education, healthcare.
There's also the dignity of a human being, that this this form of poverty that we have in this nation is this sense of low self-esteem, degradation,
right.
And that people fill up this need sometimes with consumerism, to fill up their lack with external things. But that's a form of poverty also. So the rich is
spiritual poverty,
a deep form of spiritual poverty,
yeah.
Which is the what we have to deal with in this nation, because materially speaking, even with the crisis and talk of recession, all that, we are still relatively well off.
We have abundance here.
It's a land of milk and honey.
And it's not shared, yeah.
And it's not shared. And so this sense of, like, hoarding or greed,
yeah.
I feel that very intimately of, that feels very painful to me, that this greed of, like, you were born into this world, and yet you are taking it upon yourself to hoard the riches of the world for yourself. And that's a form of sickness. That's a mental illness. We are a very addicted culture and really sick, you know. And then when you tie that sickness into, like, racism and criminalization of poor people, well, then we have a lot of problems that we do.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what people are afraid of that are holding on to their, they're hoarding on to their world. But it's a form of sickness, and I believe it has to. So that's where a doctor, a spiritual doctor, you know, genuine health is a spiritual healing,
yes,
and rehabilitation.
Let me ask you a question, because it's a question that I have sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Where does God fit into all this?
Well, I think God is real. You know, when you love another person and you come to the truth of, I mean, God, I don't believe God, that was one thing I had to understand, that God is not some kind of idea or some kind of abstract notion, but is very present among us.
Yeah.
It's a feeling. It's a feeling of complete, and being at peace with yourself. That's how one way I understand this feeling of righteous without being righteous, you know.
Chris, I wanted to also talk a little bit. I know from speaking with you, becoming a friend of yours and
mm-hmm.
you of mine, that one thing we share is that the validity of all the world's religions, and mm-hmm. it's really to get to the crux of the heart of the expression of those religions is what
mm-hmm.
seems important here. But I wanted to know, religions as structures,
mm-hmm.
what are some of your favorite teachings from them, and how do you connect them? How do you connect those dots?
Yeah, that's good. Well, also, I was thinking that this connection between science and religion, that a lot of people in the 21st century now are starting to explore connections between science and religion, but a lot of the ancient teachings didn't really make a distinction between science and religion, but it was more a way, a pathway of knowledge, a pathway of understanding. I think that some of the scriptures of India really speak to me, especially the disciplines, the various disciplines, the sense of interrelatedness of all creation in the Judaic and the Muslim tradition. This strong sense of right and wrong. Within the Christian, this passion that Christ had, and maybe some of the Zen, like just, you know, just allowing, just being part of, not forcing, you know, just doing, and being direct about things.
It's a little problematic, though, right? Like to know how to act in the world. We want to be activists. We want to act, and yet at the same time, we need to know when to step back and say, no. Not now.
Well, the Wu Wei, the do without doing,
and
that is possible. But also, I think what is also needed today, the Native American and the African and the indigenous forms of spirituality, that was when traditions, dance are more earth-centered. You know, when we talk about the planetary health and the crisis of global warming and the disconnect we have from the world and from the world of nature, I think a lot of the teachings of indigenous forms of spirituality, particularly here, the Native American, here in New York State, the Haudenosaunee people and the people of the Longhouse, and having an equality between the men and women, and actually a matriarchal, where the children are named after the mother, but having a very democratic, ecological spirituality, having democracy, ecology, and spirituality come together and have rituals. We also don't have a lot of rituals, and we need rituals. These tap into primordial instincts, I think, but I think they're also healthy. So rituals that help us to preserve our relationship to the earth and to nature is particularly needed now in the face of nuclear weapons and depleted uranium and mass consumption and these kind of things. I think we really need to explore that, and that's how I understand the connection between science and religion.
Sure. Wonderful. Yeah, I know that the Dalai Lama is set to study the interplay between scientific understanding, including quantum physics and meditation, and turning to that and bringing up the Dalai Lama, I was just wondering if you could say a few words about the occurrences of Tibet and what's going on with Tibet.
I heard at the last Saturday, the 5 years of war, beginning of the 6th year in Iraq, there was a coming together of people throughout the nation, and here locally in Buffalo there was some coming together, and there were two women from Tibet who came to that in solidarity. So I mean their solidarity was with nonviolence,
right?
That we were together because we are peaceful, in their words, peace loving people. So peace loving people who came together. Now I see the whether it's the United States or whether it's China, I think that the United Nations has to be reformed, because China, one of the things in Sudan, in Darfur, apparently China, I haven't explored the issue, but the Security Council, of which China is one of the 5 members, but the United States has also has been the solo negative voice in certain things on the Security Council also. So whether it's China or the United States or USSR or Britain, France, whatever, or any nation, for me it's like this thing of empires, this lust after wealth and power.
Yeah, it's a kind of corporate neo-feudalism.
Yes, and that needs to be addressed. So I don't know if it's helpful to point fingers at China or not look at the United States, or vice versa. I try to look at it as can we address the root cause of what is compelling from my understanding, this accumulation of wealth and power, which many nations and empires have experienced, has been dependent upon some form of slavery or war.
Right.
So to be a peace-loving person, I have to emancipate from the root causes of war and slavery. Or war and slavery are methods towards the accumulation of wealth and power. And maybe some Eastern people would say, maybe that's an expression of ego or whatever. But I try to look at it like that. So I don't want to put blame on anybody. Or certainly the violence has to end. The violence has to end in Iraq. Violence has to end in Tibet. Violence has to end in Darfur. It has to end in the ghettos of America, the reservations. It has to end in the prison system. It has to end in consumer. You know, wherever there's violence, you know, whatever the cause. I mean, it has to be. But to stand on a moralistic grounds, and to think that you're pure and that person needs to be redeemed, I think that's Dorothy Day had once said, she's don't call me a saint, I don't want to be written off that easy. You know, in other words, do the work yourself. Don't say, oh, that person was a beautiful saint, thank God for them. The important thing is to see their pathway. They opened up certain pathways, and then to take the work and build upon it. It's like the thing with the seed. Mm-hmm. You know, this person planted a seed, and now it is up to others to build upon that seed that was built.
Thank you, Chris.
Well, thank you for having me.